From NPR and WBUR, I'm Peter O'Dowd.
I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now. The global vaccine drive is in jeopardy after the Serum Institute of India announced yesterday it would not export any vaccines until the end of the year. Today, President Biden pledged to share U.S. surplus doses with COVAX, an international effort to give vaccines to low-income countries. But COVAX is still hundreds of millions of doses behind. NPR Global Health correspondent Jason Beaubien has been following all of this. So, Jason, COVAX are really struggling, but explain what is it supposed to do and more about how this news from the Serum Institute of India will affect it.
Yeah, so COVAX is this big global initiative. It came out of the World Health Organization. It involves 190 countries, and it's trying to make sure that vaccines are available everywhere in rich and poor countries alike. It's supposed to be a buyer of vaccines, this big pooled buyer, and whatever vaccines it can get a hold of, it will then dole them out proportionally around the world. And the doses are going to be free to the poorest countries in the world. And particularly for low and middle income countries, you know, that can't compete with wealthy nations in a bidding war for vaccines, this is really their best chance of getting vaccine in the short term. Unfortunately, most of the vaccine that was going to be going into COVAX this year was coming out of the Serum Institute of India. And, you know, given the acute COVID crisis that they're facing there, all of that's being diverted to the domestic Indian market, and they haven't exported anything to COVAX since February.
Yeah, I think people are surprised about how much India is in the vaccine producing business, and now they say they can't send it out of the country where people are dying at home. But how are they doing in India in controlling this outbreak?
You know, India appears to have backed away from, you know, the peak of 2 weeks ago when they were reporting about 400,000 new cases a day. But that's a drop in confirmed cases. I mean, you know, this could simply be due to the healthcare system getting overwhelmed. You got people who aren't going in to get tested. You got clinics that are more focused on treating the sick rather than running COVID tests. And some places have run out of lots of supplies, including testing supplies. You know, the COVID crisis in India is a long way from being over. And the fact that the Serum Institute is now saying that it might not be able to supply vaccines until for anywhere else other than India before 2022 is one indication of how long some people think this might get dragged out.
Yeah. Well, you know, wealthy countries can always purchase vaccines directly from manufacturers. So talk more about what happens now to these low-income countries?
Yeah, I mean, they're in a very bad spot. COVAX is up and running. It's ready. It's got the logistics to do this. But one official told me this week, you can't distribute vaccines that you don't have. COVAX has distributed about 65 million vaccines to more than 100 countries so far, but it had hoped at this point to be at about 200 million. And the gap in terms of what they need and what their goals are, they think could even get worse in June. There's a joint venture between Argentina and Mexico to produce the AstraZeneca vaccine, again for COVAX, but there have been these production delays in Mexico, and they're not expecting anything to coming off of that production line until at least sometime in June.
Well, as we said, President Biden has pledged doses, 80 million of them, to COVAX and other partners. That sounds like a lot, but is it?
You know, it definitely will help, but it is important to note that this is less than half of the global shortfall that COVAX says it's currently facing.
Well, and other countries have bought enough doses as well to vaccinate their own people many times over. Are they also going to pledge these extra vaccines?
You know, some already have. Some have donated to COVAX. But nothing on the scale of what President Biden announced this week. You know, it's important to remember that the U.S. is far ahead of most countries in the world in terms of where we are in our vaccination process. You know, we've gotten to the point here in the United States where most people can walk in, you know, without an appointment and get vaccinated now if they want to. A lot of other places and around the world do not have that luxury or that much vaccine on hand right now. So even though they may have orders for doses that are supposed to be delivered soon or this summer or later in the year, they're not keen to let go of them just yet. And politically, it might be very difficult for them to allocate doses abroad while they've got constituents at home who are still clamoring to try to get vaccinated themselves.
Yeah. Well, in the minute we have, Jason, one of the goals of COVAX was to get 20% of populations in participating countries vaccinated by 2022. So what's the sense of, you know, what it will take to do that after all of these delays?
You know, it's going to take more vaccine. And that goal is basically just to cover, you know, the healthcare workers and the most vulnerable people in these countries. That, you know, it's a very modest goal. Part of the problem is that the existing global vaccine manufacturing capacity, it's only so big, and it's already running into issues around getting access to some critical inputs. You know, you're getting delays out of Mexico, you're getting these problems in India. You know, so given that getting more out of the existing manufacturing plants is unlikely in the short term, leaders of COVAX say the place to tap right now is these extra doses that some countries are sitting on, that they've ordered. And to get those countries that have tiny portions of their population, even less than 1% of their populations, get them access to some of these doses, which may not be being used right now in some of these more wealthy countries around the world.
It's just unsettling because viruses don't stay within countries. NPR Global Health Correspondent Jason Beaubien, thank you.
You're welcome.
American farmers are trying to conserve water in the high plains of the Midwest. The region grows a quarter of the country's crops, but groundwater from the Ogallala Aquifer that irrigates the farmland is disappearing. That is the case in Kansas, where almost a third of the underground water has dried up. As David Kondos of the Kansas News Service reports, a culture shift may be the region's best shot at saving its most important source of water.
At the edge of a cornfield near the Colorado border, Rex Buchanan winds a spool of measuring tape the size of a medium pizza. He feeds the steel tape into a well that drops more than 100 feet underground. And when he reels it back up, he does some quick math.
And the depth of water is 115.1 compared to last year was 112. So this one's down 3 feet. 3 or 4 feet per year might not sound like much, but you do that year after year after year, 20 or 30 years, eventually you got a problem.
If these wells dry up for good, billions in the state's agricultural economy will evaporate with them. In parts of southwest Kansas, more than half of the aquifer supply is already gone, largely because of irrigation. When Kansas homesteaders arrived in the High Plains in the mid-1800s, the land they found was essentially desert.
High winds and sun. Without rivers, without streams, with little rain.
Western Kansas gets about half as much annual precipitation as the eastern side of the state. So the region's early farmers turn to irrigation.
Pumping 1,200 gallons of water every minute, day and night, with never a stop.
At first, they just flooded the fields. And it worked, even if it wasted half of its water to evaporation and runoff.
Once again, wheat begins to cover the plains, giving promise of another victory over the elements.
Now, the elements in western Kansas haven't exactly gotten more friendly, but the irrigation technology has advanced dramatically.
We're using electromagnetic sleds behind our GPS-driven Kubota vehicle, and it's self-driving, and they see that we're using satellite imagery and aircraft imagery and drones.
Weston McCary teaches precision agriculture at Northwest Kansas Technical College. He says all that water-saving technology can make a big difference.
You can put in all the low-E flushing toilets you want in all the metropolitan areas across this country. It will not make the dent that one producer makes when they decide to shut down 1 inch of water.
But getting farmers to actually make those changes, that could be a challenge, says environmental scientist Shannon Kenyon.
Throughout the whole history of agriculture is the mindset, okay, I'm doing it this way. This is what I know works. So when you start talking about change, that becomes a very scary concept.
Kenyon has been working at the Northwest Kansas Groundwater Management District to persuade farmers that saving water makes money. The water district set up the state's first local enhanced management area, or LEMA. That meant stricter rules on how much water farmers could pump from one particularly depleted part of the Ogallala. The goal? Cut back water use 20%.
We found that the farmers actually exceeded those targets and reduced pumping by 31%.
Stanford researcher Jillian Dinas led a recent Michigan State University study on the LEMA. It found that, yes, less irrigation meant slightly smaller harvests, but farmers still came out ahead by saving on pumping costs. Brett Oakey is one of those farmers. He says he's seen his profits go up too. More importantly, he's seen a dramatic culture shift in how his neighbors think and talk about water.
You'd say, hey, Jeff, you know, how are you doing on your water? Well, I've pumped 8 inches this year. How much have you pumped? Prior to that, nobody knew how much water they pumped, ever.
The shift hasn't always been smooth. When the Northwest Kansas Water District moved to expand irrigation limits to parts of 10 counties, it faced a lawsuit in 2019 from dozens of farmers who said it infringed on their water rights. But the limits held up in court. Still, Stuart Beckman, another Lima farmer, says arguments over how farmers should or shouldn't use the water beneath their feet continue to bubble up to the surface.
What we hear is, we think you guys are full of that you can raise as good a corn or maybe even better than they are with less water. So we just have to prove it to them.
And in a place where agriculture is king and rainfall is scarce, proving that irrigation and conservation can coexist might be the last hope for the region's water. For Here and Now, I'm David Kondos.
That song is called Sitting in the Park. It's by Billy Stewart, recorded in 1965, and it's part of one of the largest private collections of soul music ever. It has a new home. The Stax Museum of American Soul Music in Memphis is acquiring up to 35,000 vinyl records of soul music from Chicago that was collected by the late disc jockey Bob Abrahamian. We're going to slow it down now, take a break from the news, and dig into a few of the gems from this collection with Jeff Kolath. He's executive director at the Stax Museum. Jeff, thanks for coming on.
Thank you. It's wonderful to be with you.
Well, let's give a little credit to the man who collected this archive. Bob Abrahamian died in 2014. He was a pretty young guy from Chicago, a DJ with a passion for this music. How did he do it?
Yeah, he was 35, and he's somebody that I think here at the museum we're sort of in awe of, and we see somebody who thinks like we do in terms of this music and telling stories. And you know, how he got into music, how he got in particularly soul music, is not completely atypical from a lot of young kids in the 1990s. He came up listening to hip-hop, and of course at that time samples dominated the hip-hop industry, and he wanted to go back and find where this music came from, and started digging around in Chicago and, you know, in Goodwill and Salvation Army and junk stores and resale shops, and was looking for these sort of deep soul, deep funk cuts that were being sampled. And what he found instead were all these just amazing group soul records from Chicago with, you know, independent labels, private press records, and obviously the Motowns and Staxes and Chess and so on and so forth. But what he found was a bunch of music that was recorded in and around the south side of Chicago during the 1960s with addresses on the labels. And it took him on this journey that led him to finding so many of these artists and meeting them and interviewing them and telling their stories.
Let's hear some of the music he collected. This is Sitting in the Park by Billy Stewart.
Sitting in the park, waiting for why, oh, why, oh, why, oh, why, oh, why, oh, why, tell me why, won't you tell me why.
Tell me about this song.
It's just a really perfect example of the type of music that was coming out of Chicago on the soul side. Orchestration, harmony vocals, very sweet sounding music that this type of soul is often called sweet soul as well. And it's a really great Chicago record.
So that sweet soul, that's the sound of Chicago versus other places?
Versus Memphis, Detroit, the group soul sound, that harmony sound is really sort of the preeminent calling card of Chicago soul. It spawned any number of groups that were part of these local communities, and I think that's what makes this story so impactful and powerful, is that, you know, these are people from the neighborhood making records for their neighbors.
Here's another one. This is the Notations singing I Don't Want to Be Late.
We never need the flowers until old winter drives them away. The beautiful snow passes us by. It's July and summer is rushing away.
This is How Could You Love Him by Shades of Brown.
How can you love someone who don't love you? No, baby. How can you take those awful changes?
There are two more really good examples of the Chicago sound, but also a little bit newer than the Billy Stewart cut. I think the Notations records from, 1973. You hear how the sound is just contemporized a little bit, but those core hallmarks of Chicago soul are in both those records with those tight vocal harmonies. Shades of Brown is that's one of my favorite records that I've heard, and we're just scratching the surface of this collection right now.
Soul music got really popular in the United States in the late 1950s, early 60s. That last music, as you said, we just heard, came from the 1970s. But can you put that into context for us? Like, how important was it to people in these communities in Chicago?
Yeah, I mean, I think Chicago, Detroit, Indianapolis, Memphis, Columbus, Ohio, Cleveland, Ohio. I mean, there's so many cities that had these. We all know the major labels, but there are so many other smaller labels in soul scenes that just reflected what was happening in those communities. Everybody wanted to emulate Berry Gordy and try to catch fire with Motown, like Motown was able to do, and the sound of Young America. Stax, of course, on the other side of the Mason-Dixon line down here in Memphis, created a totally different sound that was really more reflective of what we had here in Memphis, which was grit and grind and that really that combination of the rural blues, electric blues, jazz, country, and sort of contemporary rock and roll.
How did it reflect what was going on in the country politically?
As a museum and as in soul scholars, we're always looking for sort of like these magic records that, specifically reflect something. And I think a lot of time there are certainly records that do that, but I think a lot of times it's this music is so strong in bringing people together. And I think it's party music, it's music, it's alone music, it's party music, it's happy music, it's sad music. And I think it's just, it becomes just a giant source of pride within the African-American community during the tumult of the 1960s, during the Civil Rights Movement, during the Black Power Movement. Not every song is Say It Loud, I'm Black and I'm Proud like James Brown. There's subtle messages throughout, but again, it's all just this connection to community and connection to people.
You're acquiring at least one very rare Stax recording, which would, of course, be of special interest to your museum. This is the Montclair's Hey You, Don't Fight It.
Hey you, hey you.
How rare is this one?
Pretty rare. If you've been to our museum before, we have on display, we have the Hall of Records. We leave gaps for the records we don't have. And this Montclair's one was one of the rare ones that we did not have. It was actually released on a subsidiary label called Arch Records out of St. Louis. The label has this really nice drawing of the St. Louis Arch. And it came out in 1968 at a time when Stax's business model had sort of been upended after its separation from Atlantic Records earlier that year, and they were rebuilding their catalog. So they signed some new artists, but then they also signed these distribution deals with other labels and producers. And so they signed a distribution deal with a disc jockey out of St. Louis by the name of Nick Charles. He was making records in his basement in St. Louis, and then the rough tracks were then sent down to Memphis to be completed here at Stax Records in Studio A and in the control room.
And they just lost track of the record?
No, it was like mini records when it came out and it was distributed, it did not make a sound, so to speak. It's a great track. The Montclairs are a great vocal group out of St. Louis. They've had a number of great singles. They put out some records on the Paula label out of Shreveport, and they're a great group, but this one just did not register.
Well, to that point, your museum is there to help protect the legacy of music like this. Do you think that, sort of broadly speaking, that we are in danger of losing some of the the history and the record of Soul.
The way that we talk about it is, you know, next year will be the 60th anniversary of Otis Redding's first recordings at Stax Records. The Shaft LP came out 50 years ago this summer. And so as we get further and further away from when these records were made, we're obviously losing the men and women that made those records, both in terms of the artists on the front of the LP and the session players on the back, plus the producers and the graphic artists and the photographers and the people that worked for the businesses too. So we're losing, what we are losing is we're losing those stories. And so I think for us, it's not only building our collection of physical objects, but it's building our collection of stories too, and really just wanting to be able to tell as many people's stories as possible.
Let's do one more before we go. This is Black Zodiac's cover of Put Your Money Where Your Mouth Is, a song from the 1976 movie Car Wash.
Put your money where your mouth is.
I love that.
Anything that's got a bass line like that, I think will always, you know, get people up and dancing, you know, out on the dance floor. I mean, fun music is fun music. You know, great music never goes out of style.
Well, Jeff Kolath, keep searching because those stories are well worth it. Thank you so much. Executive Director at the Stax Museum in Memphis, Tennessee, it was a pleasure to speak with you.
Thank you. It was great to be here.
Good question.
That's a really good question.
It's a great question.
This is free therapy.
Thank you for asking me that.
God, that's such a good question.
That's an interesting question.
But what Fresh Air interviews are really about are the interesting answers. Listen and subscribe to Fresh Air from WHYY and NPR.
Let's go to France now, among the countries easing COVID restrictions. Today, bars, shops, and museums open their doors. Small groups of people can now eat together on outdoor restaurant terraces. But wait, didn't they just have another wave of COVID just a few weeks ago? The BBC's Hugh Schofield is there. And Hugh, great news. We all wish we could be outside in Paris. But didn't you just have a lockdown?
Yeah, and we're coming out of it. You're right to sort of bring this up. By comparison with some other countries, for example, the UK, we're coming out of this lockdown at a time when the statistics are still relatively high. I mean, there is still quite a large number of people falling ill with COVID, but the trend is quite clearly downwards. The vaccination program is really digging in now. And the calculation made by Macron and his team is that it is safe, or safe enough, shall we say, to go ahead with this gradual easing. The big symbol of that, of course, is the famous terraces of cafes and restaurants, which are opening up this morning and where people can now come and enjoy themselves. Though I have to say the weather is so appalling today that the number of people who are taking it up is actually quite small.
Even appalling, you know, in France is worth it. But is this about getting local economies going, or is this about getting tourism back? I mean, how much has the French economy suffered?
Drastically, as have all economies. It's not really about tourism, because I don't think they're really banking on a big return of tourism this year. And if, you know, Macron is maybe pushing a little bit harder than other leaders in trying to open up and not being super cautious about the figures and the number of infections and so on, it's because from the start he said that this is a global decision. It's not just about, you know, the number of people who are getting COVID. It's also about the mental health of the nation and the economic health of the nation and how much we can force people into a lifestyle which is really so uncongenial and leading to so much pressure. We need to release that pressure where we can, and that's what's happening today. And it's certainly true that people have been really, really looking forward to today as a sign that there is hope that this will all end.
Well, that's what I was going to ask you just briefly. How are people responding? I mean, it's pouring rain. It's not lovely out. But, you know, do you expect that the mood is that people are going to say, yeah, I'm going out? Will they still wear masks? Are there people who are worried? What's been the response?
undoubtedly people are absolutely delighted, despite the weather. And even if they're not going to, sitting outside in the cafes as you'd like to think they would be, you know, in a spring morning, but they're going to the cinemas. I mean, a lot of people, I mean, the French are great cinephiles, and they love the cinema. For many, that's a great joy now, to be able to go back and sit in the big darkened hall and feel that thrill again. The shopping, you know, they can go to Galerie Lafayette, they can go to their local shoe shop, which they couldn't do before. I mean, that's all coming back to life. And it's, in the urban environment, things are springing up out of the cement again.
Including people. The BBC's Hugh Schofield in Paris. Thank you.
Thank you.
The path to trace ancestry erased by the Holocaust is well trod. As Menachem Kaiser writes in his new memoir, it's a book genre, and he's a little jealous of all the other grandchild authors who seem to so easily find the stories of their grandparents. Him? Not so much. In 2010, Menachem began his quest to reclaim a building in Poland a grandfather he never knew grew up in. But there were tenants, court battles, maybe the wrong building. And suddenly we're plunged into Menachem's 8-year journey, a Gulliver's Travels with a little Yiddish. He has to prove his relatives died in the Holocaust. He's swept up by treasure hunters who explore a secret underground world of the Nazis and who follow and revere a relative of Menachem's. Along the way, he wonders, who is plundering, the treasure hunters or him, plundering memory? Menachem Kaiser's new book is Plunder, a memoir of family property and Nazi treasure. And Menachem, you write that this started when you were in Poland. Your father faxed you a pile of documents about your grandfather's building. What happened?
Something really shifted. I really felt, really for the first time in my life, a sentimental connection with my grandfather, because I saw that he had failed for 30 years trying to get back this building. And I was in this, you know, unique position to, you know, resume his quest. I felt like I could sort of be in conversation with him. Mm-hmm. And so somewhat on a whim, but sort of like this amorphous sentimental motivation, I set down that path.
Well, and it almost immediately goes south because you decide to pretend that you're doing a documentary about this building, but the building is also pretending it's not your grandfather's childhood home. It was an investment property. And we're now in an absurdist play. The court's demanding that you prove your grandfather, who would be like 140 or something, that he's dead. Are you starting to feel like a little ensnared by this story?
Yes. This was a building that my grandfather owned. And so I just assumed that he had grown up there. And so that gave it a whole sort of sentimental basis for what I was doing. But it turned out not to be the case. And then it turned out I spent like 2 years dealing with the residents of a particular building. And then it turned out that building actually was the wrong building. So the main legal hurdle was trying to prove the deaths of my relatives who had died in the Holocaust. And my great-grandparents would be, you know, nearly 140 years old. You would think that'd be kind of a slam dunk, but it was not.
Well, you also had this mindset, as who wouldn't, you know, that you're going to be playing this role. At some point, you're saying, okay, I'm going to play the part of the Jew returning to claim my property, and you're going to play the part of the angry Pole. And yet some of them were very, very nice. You know, it didn't work out, you know, as you thought it would. But here's where we have to warn listeners to, you know, hold on to their hats, because we're going to veer sharply, as you did. You end up in the Silesia region of Poland. It could be the most densely treasure-hunted, treasure-packed region in the world, myths that go back to the 1500s. And then, of course, more recent ones, conspiracy theories, really about Nazis using underground tunnels for time travel and to hide the loot of a golden train. It's all centered around a Nazi complex. Riza, tell us about that.
So Project Riza is a series of 7 underground complexes dug by the Nazis using mostly Jewish slave labor towards the end of the war. And so these are really sort of staggeringly enormous structures, square kilometers of area. So they're really quite like underground cavernous neighborhoods. But what makes them truly enigmatic is the fact that there is virtually no primary documentation as to what the Germans were planning to use them for. They've sort of become a pretty mythologized place and attracted quite a bit of like these conspiracy theorists and treasure hunters.
Quite amazing. But in one of the world's greatest coincidences, their Bible of treasure hunting is an obscure and poignant Holocaust memoir written by your grandfather's first cousin.
Yeah. this diary that was written by a slave laborer named Abraham Kaiser, he wrote on like stolen scraps of cement packaging, and he would nail these scraps to the underside of the latrines. And after the war, he collected them, and they were published in Poland in the early 60s. This has become sort of the sacred text among the treasure hunter community, owing to the details of the tunnels inside the book. You know, I never heard of him. I grew up with the sort of knowledge that everyone in my grandfather's family had been wiped out. So his parents, his siblings, all his aunts, uncles, and cousins. So really, like in an instant, my family went from extinct to not extinct.
Well, you went from somebody coming to take back a building to a hero to the hunters, whining and dining you and lots of vodka. And look, it's Abraham Kaiser's grandson. You'd say, no, they didn't hear that. So you start playing the part of Abraham Kaiser's grandson and start getting increasingly uncomfortable because Abraham talks about the starvation, the beatings, the woman who hides him in a potato bin. But they, the hunters, are focusing on the tunnels.
The way I would describe it is that they approach the book as sort of the textual equivalent of a treasure map. And, you know, the more I learned about Abraham, I'm missing the person. That was ended up being a big struggle for me. How can I get closer to him, his own personal legacy, and not how he's been mythologized by the treasure hunters? But as I got to know them better, I really saw a sort of sense of collective responsibility to these sites. And these are sites that are way off the maps. They're very far from like the main sites of Holocaust memory, like the Auschwitz. And it's this community that's taking care of them. One of the treasure hunters is a guy named Krzysztof, and he had dedicated a few years to tracking down a concentration camp that had been wiped off the map. And he brought me out to a field, empty field, and he showed me in the grass a line of cemented in bricks. And that had been the foundation of the barracks.
And you decide to follow Abraham Kaiser's route from concentration camp to concentration camp, these relatively unknown camps that he writes about. It is dizzying. You write at one point to us, the reader, my experience is starting to bleed together. I'm guessing something similar is happening to you. And I said out loud, Menachem, oh, that happened a long time ago. It's like, this story is so incredible. So you find this incredible, lovely story of Abraham, but not much about your grandfather. And you wrote at one point, I had hoped to fade out my book on a successful reclamation of my ancestral property, a triumphant finishing of my grandfather's unfinished business. How would you describe what happened?
I really liked how you said it before. I think I came in with a sense of that this is a familiar story, a grandchild going back to his grandparents' ancestral homeland on a sort of memory mission. But as I got deeper in, it just became less and less familiar. And I sort of had less and less like touchstones to understand my own story. It really challenges your sort of preconceived sense of how a story like this is supposed to go. And it just was not going how I thought it would go or how everyone feels it should or how it's gone in the past. It was like up to me to make my own meaning. And I try to be honest that I don't always know the answers, both in the book and in life. I sort of just threw my hands up and said, I don't know what this is. Like, I don't know what it means, and but I'm trying.
What would you say to others who have thought about this? And we should say that there are Jews who lost everything overnight. What would you say about someone who says, I want that back?
I don't pretend to be an authority on the issue of reclamation. When it comes to sort of taking something back that belonged to your family, the meanings of these things that we take back are going to have very, very personal and unique meanings. But for me, what happened was because the process to reclaim it became such a frustrating process, it forced me to interrogate what the building actually meant and sort of revealed in a way that I did not anticipate. The building was just a building. It was me who was creating the meaning of that symbol, and I was forced to interrogate my own motivations. For me, that's where the real value was. What does it mean to reach towards my grandfather? And so how do I sort of create the meaning of his memory? You know, I found that to be a frustrating ending, but like an enormously valuable one, because it really forced me to wrestle with who he was and who I was relative to him.
Well, and I was thinking, you also got Abraham. And you wouldn't have had a clue about this relative of yours. Is there any attempt to maybe republish this memoir of his?
Yeah. So there's been a tremendous amount of interest in an English edition of Abraham's memoir. And I hope to have it out in early 2022.
There you go. Menachem Kaiser, his new book is Plunder, a memoir of family property and the Nazi treasure. Oh, by the way, well, we can't spoil the ending. It has something to do with golden eggs. Were they there?
I can't say yet, but I'm hoping to be able to say soon.
Oh, excellent. Menachem, thank you.
Thank you.
Mysterious brain injuries similar to those reported by U.S. diplomats and spies overseas have started to appear here in the United States. In a typical case, a victim hears a sudden strange noise in their homes or in their hotel rooms, and then neurological problems set in, debilitating headaches, memory loss, vertigo. Now the Biden administration has ramped up an investigation into what and who could be behind the attacks. Edward Wong is diplomatic correspondent for the New York Times, and he joins us now. Edward, good to speak with you.
Hi, Peter.
Well, look, the U.S. government now believes that these attacks have happened on American soil, actually not far from the White House. What do we know about that?
There have been two cases that U.S. officials have focused on as possible cases in the U.S. One was an episode that took place on the ellipses near the White House, and this affected a staff member of the National Security Council. In another incident, there was an episode involving a White House staffer who was walking her dog in Northern Virginia. And in both these cases, the people suffered health effects. I've heard that in one of the cases, it was more serious and the effects are lingering. And there are some officials who are asking whether these are the same types of episodes that have taken place overseas in places like Cuba, China, other parts of Asia, and Europe.
Well, in fact, when we first started hearing about these attacks on American officials in Cuba, it was several years ago. But since those first cases have been reported, how widespread have they become around the globe?
They're a lot more common than we thought they were. When we looked at this last year, we thought the number of cases was around, you know, 60 or so. It turns out that there are around 130 or more cases. U.S. officials are asking whether these 130 episodes are all related in some way and whether, you know, a foreign power or foreign powers carried out attacks that would have affected U.S. citizens. Most of them are U.S. citizens who are involved in national security or foreign policy.
And just remind us, how serious are the injuries?
These are brain injuries we're talking about. And I've talked with victims who say there have been very serious long-term effects. They say that they still hear things at certain times of the day. Their vision might be affected. They experience balance issues. And I've also spoken with ones whose family members are still suffering effects even several years after the first episodes.
So that's the what in this mysterious story. But there are many other questions, like who is doing this and how are they doing it? There's a report out by the National Academies of Science, came out in December, that said it was probably a microwave weapon. Explain that. And is that essentially where we stand with the explanation at this point, that it was a microwave weapon?
Right. The NAS report, they don't have definitive evidence that it was a microwave weapon. But they said, like, through the process of elimination and looking at the symptoms and looking at previous episodes involving microwaves, they believe that it was a microwave weapon. You know, there's been one foreign power, Russia, or the Soviet Union back then in the 1970s, 80s, that U.S. officials suspect of having used a microwave weapon on the American embassy in Moscow and causing injuries to officials there. And so a lot of U.S. officials have mentioned Russia in this context. Russian officials say that they have no idea what's going on. They obviously say that they're not responsible for this. And they also point out that U.S. officials often like to blame many things on Russia. And the American officials do say that, you know, all the evidence is circumstantial and there's no hard evidence that points directly at Russia.
Here's what I don't understand. What is a microwave weapon? Many times these people are reporting being attacked or having symptoms when they're outside, walking through a gate, walking their dogs, in the car. How would a microwave weapon do this from a purely functional point of view?
Well, that's part of the question. And I think that the scientists who wrote the NAS report didn't have a concrete answer for that either. There would have to be some miniaturization of the technology in order to create a weapon that can be carried around by foreign agents. And no one knows for sure whether that's been done. No one knows what it would look like. It's a real mystery.
Hmm. Why would anyone want to do this?
You know, foreign powers might just want to destabilize operations. We know of some cases that occurred involving CIA operatives or agents, and they were out traveling overseas to discuss counterintelligence operations against Russia with other foreign officials, maybe counterparts in other intelligence agencies. So there's this Russia element that keeps lingering in some of these cases. And there's a question of whether Russia or some other power is trying to disrupt operations, U.S. operations, or disrupt U.S. intelligence practices or U.S. missions, things like that.
Edward Wong is a diplomatic correspondent for the New York Times. Thank you very much for speaking with us.
Thanks a lot, Peter.
What a mystery. I could listen to those stories every day.
I know, when you said point, the one question I have, I said, how, you only have one?
It's endless. Here and Now is a production of NPR and WBUR. I'm Peter O'Dowd.
I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now.